Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And I'm Philip Sage with ARMS Reliability in Australia.
Hey, Philip. I think we've got this working finally. We've tried, three different systems? So we've got levels of redundancy, except we don't have separate comm lines. We need to run our own fiber if we really want to make this work all the time. This is our second day trying to get a recording where it was stable. So we're going to keep our fingers crossed. But it's one of those things that, you know, and I know that you've been working from home quite a bit, and like most, a lot of us are. I mean, how often do you have communications problems in general?
It happens from time to time, and it's generally associated with the broader network here in Australia. Although there were times when the school kids were all home, and as they logged on to their courses that were being taught remotely during the school day, there were some periods where there was bandwidth issues here in the local neighborhood. But yeah, right. It does happen, but not always.
I know. And, you know, it's, I still remember I was working with Hewlett Packard, and we had a team in Singapore, and we would prepare for a meeting with them, a teleconference by phone, not video, just phone. And we would all get in a conference room, and they would get in their conference room, and we'd meet. And then if we wanted to send documents to each other, usually we had to think of it the day prior, and then we would either FedEx that to them if we had time, enough time, we'd send paper copies. In last minute things, we had to send a fax. And that was what we were doing. And then one day, one of the guys in Singapore said, why don't we try sending that by email? You know, this, you know, like a 4-page document or 10-page document or, you know, and something that we would normally would have faxed. And we sat in the meeting, and one of the guys typed it up and sent it off. And the guys in Singapore, quicker than I could tell you the sentence, said, "Oh, got it." And it was amazing. And, yeah. And now, you know, if somebody sends you email and it doesn't show up in 3 seconds, you think the world's ending. It's a terrible thing.
Yeah. I can reminisce in the days before, well, even the days before pagers, where it was, if you were going to be out of the office, that was okay, but you had to call the office secretary at 11 o'clock or 1 o'clock to check in and see if there were any messages for you, if anybody was trying to get a hold of you.
That's right.
Yep.
It's a different world. But I think what comes with that, though, and I think one of the topic I wanted to bring up with you is, you know, as reliability folks, we often are part of a risk assessment program of some sort. So will this equipment function as we're trying to use it, or is this design have any problems with it that's, you know, we're not going to have the appropriate spares or tools or equipment? Have we thought through what could go wrong? And we can do that in the design stage or process or installation or all kinds of ranges, but those are usually for a very specific system or product or item in FMEA type tools or hazard analysis type tools. What I'm thinking, though, is that, you know, like if I sat down to my computer, or like I did yesterday, and said, "Oh, I'm gonna open this up, and I got a good connection, it should just work," is that I can only touch an endpoint of a very complex system that goes to you and makes this audio connection and allows us to record. I think more and more of our systems, though, are getting to where we're just a part of a much larger system that many people have a play into it. And so it brings to my mind is the risk analysis or risk management type stuff in our day-to-day work is, if we stop with what's in front of us or on the shop floor, we're missing all of those other elements that play a role in it. So like Internet of Things, if we're doing cloud storage and computing on that stuff, well, now that's orders of magnitude more complex of all these things that have to work.
Yeah, I agree. And as we make the world more and more complex, it becomes harder and harder to analyze. And certainly, to, if you're trying to do a quantitative analysis where you're calculating the likelihood from some probabilistic basis, the basis of which you make that that failure data estimate, it becomes a little bit more convoluted and has to be thought out differently.
Well, you know, I can't imagine that, you know, like a chemical plant dealing with hazardous materials or hazardous chemicals is going to rely on a cloud-based monitoring system. I think we're still, and like we, you and I have seen in the last 2 days, is that you can't always get a clear signal just out of your neighborhood sometimes. So it's, I think, you know, I'm sure there's people thinking of that and doing stuff like that, but I don't know if the like TUV would certify somebody as on a safety performance issue if they're using, you know, cloud-based monitoring systems. I just don't see that yet.
I don't think that would happen yet, especially for a major hazard facility or a critical safety risk, like an in-flight risk. I think you can still derive a lot of benefit from the cloud-based systems and knowledge, but the core safety instrumented function has to be kind of standalone, robust, and provable. And when you push something out into the cloud, I think today most people don't even know where that is.
No, it's not the white fluffy stuff up overhead like they in the pictures. But no, yeah. And, you know, a lot of times it changes too. I know the where I store, like the podcast files are stored on a cloud server. And depending on where you're streaming from, it will relocate. It'll serve the file from a server bank or server farm or whatever they call it that's closest to you to reduce latency. It's kind of scary. Now, what I'm thinking of though is, let's say, well, let me introduce it this way, is one of the paradigms that engineering teams often get into trouble with, and I'm sure you've seen this, Philip, is we've got a problem. We're smart engineers. We'll solve it. We'll come up with a new design. And you go say, all right, can we do this? Does it work? Is it effective? And then you implement it. And then something else breaks because they forgot the step of stepping back and saying, well, what does this change, this extra 10 pounds on this part of the equipment? What does that do to my natural frequency? Or what is that? What else changes because of the change we just made in the larger system? But I don't think that's quite sufficient anymore. Is as we make a change, say, locally on a factory floor or within a product design, one, you got to step back and say, what else changes? What happens? But now we also have to step back and say, well, what changes in our supply chain? What changes in our maintenance procedures? What changes in our reporting ability? And so on. And then it goes out from there. How does this affect product quality? Things like that. I don't know of good tools available that address that. And so it's, one is just the concept, and two is what do we do about it?
Yeah, the challenge has been out there for quite a while. And, you know, even since the 40s and 50s, a variety of tools have been developed, and they've found their way into the reliability profession. Certainly the FMEA and FAMICA approach is well established and been out there for about 60 years, those approaches probably have a million different variants depending on what you want to apply that against. My favorite, and I still use quite a lot today, is a fault tree analysis, mm-hmm. especially when you're using dealing with standalone dormant systems, like for example, most recently a spillway gate that fails to open when the water gets too high. That's the nature of the hazard. Okay. Or even in the reliability block diagram approach for modeling the virtualization of terrain control that has been moved off of physical servers into the virtual world, where you have a VMware and a hypervisor and a variety of different server farms. They're now operating those servers virtually that are still being controlled to the physical trains that are controlling the movement of, say, a million people a day. So, you know, the techniques are still, I think, fundamentally sound. But today, the bigger complication is as you move into the hybrid systems where you have humans and you have governance control systems interfaced with hardware and software that are difficult at times to define their failure characteristics, are really moving into the world where you've got this large picture that you need to analyze. And I've been reading up on Nancy Levinson's, she's from MIT. She's proposed and put out a system theoretic accident model, or STAMP is the acronym. Mm-hmm. And it's a more of a high level, I guess I'll paraphrase it, but my understanding is it's a high level hybrid between the automated controls and the human and the governance and the policy decisions that are being made. So it's an interesting problem. There's a lot of people trying to solve it. And it, depending on which piece of the problem that you're working on, you need to select the tool that's best suited to be able to provide the value.
Yeah, no, you just raised a number of different examples that, you know, are exploring that larger realm of what's going on. And fault tree and block diagrams and modeling and FMEAs are all practical tools. Yet in the world I work in, it's usually focused on, say, a design of a widget, for example. And a difficult part is the resistance to saying, well, the user can use it however they want, and that they bring on those hazards themselves. And in some parts of the world, is if you do something silly or foolish with a product and you get hurt, well, that's on you, right? In some parts of the world, like the United States, is the designers have to think through all of the silly things that idiots can do with your product that will hurt them. And then you got to deal with that. And then if they do hurt themselves, the famous case of the woman that put, you know, burned her legs with hot coffee and then sued them because the coffee was hot. You know, so, okay. I chuckle at that. I'm sure the burn was serious and not, you know, but if you order hot coffee, they make it hot. That's kind of the nature of the deal there. And,
yeah.
But when you start thinking about liabilities and just wanting to make a product safe, it includes this, and I ran into this recently, was it includes this notion that you need to make it, you have to reduce the hazards to an acceptable risk level or acceptable, you know, hazard level, risk level. And of course, then the very first question is, well, what's that? And then I, you know, all the standards that I could find say, well, that is up to your decision maker. Yes. So, okay, punt. But the hard part was getting I find resistance to, well, I only can control this part. I can't control how the user person uses the product. Yet you brought up a couple of examples where it's, you know, implementing policy decisions or making control decisions. And there's a lot of variability about how people do that stuff. And it's not unknown. It's just variable. And including the end users into it is just one step. But then there's factors of business objectives. And I'm sure you've seen it, is the acceptable risk changes as you get closer to launch date, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing how that works. But it's because there is a real influence of business decisions and return on investment and shareholder value and meeting your customers' expectations if you promise it on a certain date. But those don't work themselves into an FMEA or a block diagram easily, those other influences.
No, it's and when you look at the total risk for any aspect, whether it's a widget, a cell phone being manufactured and shipped around the world, or space flight, or, you know, your commercial air flight, I think all of those aspects need to be considered dealt with. And there's a variety of different tools for doing that effectively. But the challenge, of course, is to render an analysis that gives you some confidence and some insight as to the areas of whatever that you're trying to tackle that provide the highest contribution to the problem, that those are elevated so you can prioritize those and focus on them and try to minimize the likelihood that that particular scenario would surface after that product or is in the market, or the airplane takes off, or the rocket leaves the launch pad, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I was kind of going with the thought, well, these tools aren't serving us, but I think it's the FMEA, and if we go through and think through the hazards and the functional failures that could occur, or hazard analysis, think through what are the potential hazards, that it will still carry biases into that room or into that analysis or into the model creation, depending on where we are in the program and process and what business forces or customer forces are at play. Yet I suspect, is what you just alluded to, is that we'll come out with that, oh, XYZ is the most likely thing to occur and cause problems, and it's the highest risk that we need to deal with. Or an FMEA, here's the thing that's going to happen most often with the highest severity, and we need to go deal with that. The relative ranking will probably remain relatively the same to independent of the exterior forces and motivations that occur. Is that?
Yeah, I think in general it will. The challenge, of course, is to understand on what scale am I ranking this? When we deal with risk, it's a very broad topic. When we deal with a very focused area of risk, like our company's reputation, mm-hmm. or damage to the environment, or safety, mm-hmm. To either the person holding the product or to the people that are making the product, those are very, very focused areas of risk. And the one that creeps into the maintenance management world is, of course, cost in manufacturing. The cost of maintenance is a direct debit to profit, mm-hmm. but it's a necessary requirement, and it actually can provide additional value as a profit center if it's taken and approached correctly.
Right.
But depending on what your focus is, I've participated in FMEAs where the focus was the likelihood that this incident would end up in the 6 o'clock news, and mm-hmm. And the amount of time that it would get on the news was the consequence ranking scale. So, risk can also be financial, and in portfolios, the risk of wildfires that you're dealing with in California today, or starting a wildfire, or as we call bushfires, mm-hmm. Started by the electrical transmission or distribution business, is a very serious concern for those utilities. And in petrochemical, the risk is more broad in that you have a serious accident or explosion, or in the case of Bhopal, India, released toxic gas into the community that kills several, I can't remember the exact
thousands amount, of people, yeah.
Thousands of people, yeah. So, risk comes, it's a very broad term. But when we focus on risk, we need to begin to immediately define what category of risk is it that we're trying to evaluate and minimize. And, whatever sticks up as the biggest risk in that category, I think no matter generally how you analyze it, is going to end up being the biggest risk identified in that category. And the methods, while they may not pin it down certainly in a qualitative approach, they will be quantized as to the likelihood and or the consequence when you use a risk matrix. Mm-hmm. But it's still, it gets you in the ballpark. And if you don't have anything else, being in the right ballpark in the right city is still, in the right state is still not a bad approach to trying to tackle the problem of what to do with second base.
Well, exactly right. And I think the idea is that it's, you know, one step, obviously, in this whole risk management thing is identifying the risks and getting, and I hadn't thought of that. I'm so used to doing design FMEAs that I don't really shift gears all that much for the other ones. But even in a design FMEA where I'm looking at the hazards of certain functions not working or design able to meet those requirements, safety still plays a role in that. In the severity rankings, is the anything that's the high severity ones are usually safety related in some form, or very expensive or capital destructive or stuff like that. And so the things that apply, whether it's a hazard analysis or an FMEA or even a fault tree, is, yes, I agree with you, Philip, that we got to think through, well, what's the rubrics we're using? What's the focus we're using? How are we basing our scoring? But I think when something triggers that safety part of it, it needs to get attention independent of whether it's going to be expensive or not. You know, if it only kills one person and compared to lost production, which is $40 million, well, where do you draw the line in the balance there? You know, the killing somebody is going to get you on the news. Losing $40 million will get you on the stock ticker. That's a tough one to call, but I think it still has to be there. All of these different tools end up having some element of safety gets triggers unique consideration. And I think that's still important.
Yeah, I think the priority in many mantras, safety is first. In some organizations, they don't act that way, but still, they speak it. But I think we have to take safety first and injury and or loss of life as a key thing that you have to try very, very hard to make sure that it doesn't happen and that we do everything that we can to prevent those. So I think those are, you know, kind of absolutes in my mind. That we have to treat that at that level. Yeah. It's interesting. FAA puts a plug number cost at $1 million for each passenger killed in a crash, or allowing the airlines to equate a cost analysis, in their risk analysis approach. So it is, I don't advocate that is the right, the right thing to do, maybe to put a number on the loss of life. But in order to get to the end of the analysis and reasonably conclude that you have reduced the risk to as low as reasonably practicable, which is a term that means it's low, but also that it's sustainably low through your procedures and your operations and manufacturing and so forth. The challenges are to understand all of those complicated issues and get them on the table, get them discussed and quantified as best you can so that you can make an informed decision.
Yeah. Well said. So I started off kind of probing around, are our tools adequate, the ones that help us prioritize and understand the set of risks in front of us and in these larger interconnected contexts. And I think at this point I'm going, I think our tools serve us well if we use them well. I think there's still that notion. Yes. You gotta actually do the work to understand these issues and work it through. So I'm happy with that. I think that and we were able to record for 20 minutes without dropping a line. So that wasn't happening yesterday. So knock on wood here. It's one of those things. Let me ask our listeners, if you're dealing with risk management in some form or fashion and fitting in the use of your tools, FMEAs and fault trees and so on, how's that going for you? What's working? What's not working? How do you get through the barriers of helping people expand beyond what's immediately in front of them to look at the how things interconnect and affect each element in all those different realms? Or if you've got a separate question, that's fine too. I'm not going to limit you to that. We do certainly love hearing from you. One way to do that is go to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a contact form there that you can join the conversation. You can also find Philip and I and the other hosts on LinkedIn and on our About pages on Ascendo Reliability. So with that, Philip, I think we've minimized the risk of a failed connection. Not that we had much of anything to do with it. But we'll take barely done, but to change the day. So obviously it wasn't life threatening for us because we could just delay a day and we're working fine. So with that, Philip, I'll let you go. And I also made a couple of notes on other topics here. I think the fault tree idea, we'll have to explore again in more detail and a good practices for that. So I have some questions there too. So with that, thanks much, Philip. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Good to hear your voice.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.